I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's late on Thursday, October 29th. As we record this, the number of coronavirus cases around the world stands at nearly 45 million. That's up 3.5 million since last week's episode. 65,000 more people have died around the world in that time. The global death toll has now reached 1.78 million. That's all according to the Johns Hopkins University tracker. Here in Ireland, 1,902 people have died with COVID-19. That's up 31 in 1 week. Total cases now stand at over 60,000, and that's up nearly 6,000 since last week's episode. Looking ahead to next week, the Taoiseach announced today that schools would reopen on Monday, in case you were concerned, listener.
There's a genuine and general desire to keep our schools open. We will do everything we possibly can to support teachers, SNAs, school secretaries, everybody who works in the school environment, to keep our school environment safe.
Can you tell parents today that schools will definitely open on Monday?
Yes.
And it's only 4 days away.
Yeah, we have nothing to say that they will not. We're saying they will open. Of course they will open on Monday. And we'll continue the engagement with all the partners, but they will open on Monday. Yeah.
We may return to the issue of schools in an upcoming episode soon. It's generating quite a lot of debate and we may have a look at the data on them. But today, in a slight departure from the usual format, listener, seeing as we remain under level 5 restrictions, and will do for some time, we're going to look abroad in a moment, specifically to Belgium. It's on the cusp of a lockdown. It follows in the steps of France and Germany because of the escalating number of cases there. But first, on this episode, we're going to give over extra time to the issue of long COVID. You may not have heard of it. It doesn't get much coverage. People who may have had no diagnosis and people who have are finding themselves with debilitating illnesses which they find hard to explain and little certainty of when what they're suffering from might end because so little is known about it. Dr. Elaine Maxwell is a professor of nursing. She's a former intensive care nurse and she's clinical advisor at the National Institute for Health Research Dissemination Centre in the UK. I'll let her introduce herself. So could you introduce yourself, tell us what your name is and what your role is?
So my name is Elaine Maxwell. I work for the National Institute for Health Research, which is a government-funded body for England. And my role is to look at different pieces of evidence around a given subject and to make sense of them and bring them together into something that sheds light on a particular health problem.
So today we're going to look at long COVID, this being the pandemic podcast and looking at things about COVID. That's a term you don't like, and we'll get into why you don't like that particular term in a moment. But insofar as it is possible to say what long COVID is, can you first of all give us an insight into when this came up on the radar of medical professionals and when it began to be recognised as a syndrome or a number of syndromes that people were encountering?
Firstly, it's not that I don't like the term. It's a term that a lot of people suffering use. I don't think it's very specific and it sort of lumps a whole load of things in together. But to answer your question, it became apparent quite early that people who had been acutely ill with a COVID infection were taking a long time to recover. And so a lot of attention was initially focused on people who'd been in hospital. Then I think it was probably around May, June that people started to realise that there were some people who hadn't actually been that ill with their COVID infection initially and had stayed at home and maybe not even been tested, who were now becoming ill. And there's been increasing awareness that this is a problem for a whole range of people and that it presents in different ways, which is why we think in order to understand this better we need to dig down a bit more and not just call all of it long COVID.
And what kind of symptoms have people been presenting with, as in is there a list of some or all of which Or is it a way that attacks different people's systems in very different ways, depending on what they're already dealing with?
Well, what we saw was that people can have symptoms in every part of their body and their brain. So you get people talking about COVID toes, we've got people talking about pins and needles, we've got people talking about brain fog, we've got people who've got heart problems, you know, gut problems, anywhere. What we looked at is the pattern of symptoms. So there are different patterns of symptoms that people experience. There are the people who've been acutely in an hospital who are having the same sort of problems you might expect for anybody who's had a critical illness, in terms of they're very weak and they need a lot of rehabilitation. Their pattern of symptoms can be quite different from people who've actually got damage to some of their organs as a result of either the virus or having low oxygen levels or having blood clots, because we know clotting is an issue with COVID. Then there's some people who have something that look very much like post-viral fatigue syndromes, the sort of ME, chronic fatigue syndromes. But then there is another group who have an unusual pattern in that they have fluctuating symptoms.
You've described this as a roller coaster.
Yes. So this is a word they themselves use. So they will say that, and often these people that we've talked to were not acutely ill in hospital. They were managing at home. And they will say that their symptoms now are worse than when they had their acute COVID infection. So they will say they started off with respiratory symptoms and they would have days when they felt better and days when they felt worse. But then it would get progressively better and they think, right, I'm over that. And then all of a sudden they'd plunge down because they'd start having heart symptoms and they were really frightening. They talk about having heart pain and not thinking they're going to survive the night. And this fluctuates and then those go away and they think, that's great, I'm better. And then they'll get neurological symptoms. And it's this roller coaster, both of the intensity of the symptoms, but also about the symptoms moving around the body that seems different from some of the other groups.
And what has the experience been of these people going to general practitioners when they present and give a list of these symptoms? What has their experience been in terms of diagnosis or onward referral?
So it's been mixed, but a lot of people have found it very difficult to get help. So I think it's very challenging for health professionals because we've been completely overwhelmed with this new disease. And quite obviously, the immediate concern is on life-threatening symptoms. There's a lot of information coming out for health professionals, and it's really hard for them to assimilate all that. Having said all that, there are people we've heard of who, because they haven't got a laboratory test saying they had COVID in the first place, then people don't take their symptoms seriously. And also because these symptoms fluctuate, sometimes they will describe something horrendous, but by the time they see their GP, they're not experiencing that. So it's very hard for the GPs, but it also leaves these people devastated because they don't know what's going to happen. They just know that people are not sure what they're saying. And they're very frightened that they're going to leave the GP surgery and go home and they get these terrible pains that they don't know what it is and they don't know the prognosis.
And in an obviously anxious state, they may present to their GP concerned about their own condition. But in one of the cases you read about, somebody was informed by an ambulance crew that they were having a heart attack. I've seen concern expressed elsewhere of a phenomenon known as medical gaslighting, or people being suggested to people that they are imagining their symptoms because, as you say, some people don't have an original COVID diagnosis laboratory test to maybe alert medical professionals as to what this might be.
Yeah, so we talked about somebody whose GP had recognised she's 8 months after her original infection, and her GP had said, yes, you've got long COVID, you've definitely got problems. And she got a new symptom, this whole thing about getting new symptoms. She suddenly, 8 months in, started getting fainting and dizziness, and she called an ambulance and they said, you're having a panic attack, because it's very hard for health professionals to keep up with this new emerging information that there is this new syndrome that they don't understand. But it is really frightening. And then I think there's another issue, which is because of the symptoms and the uncertainty about what's causing it, people are very anxious. So health professionals sometimes see the anxiety and think the anxiety causes the symptoms rather than the symptoms causing the anxiety. And so there is some concern that people who've got real physical problems that are potentially very serious won't get investigated because they have been labelled as being anxious and not having a real physical disease. So there are some real risks around not taking this seriously.
It's about, I've read, and this is according to research by, I think, King's College London, that's quoted in the Financial Times, about 1.5 to 2% of people are still suffering with symptoms after 3 months. But the median age of those with long COVID is 45, and women are more likely to be affected.
So we've looked at a whole range of studies, including the Zoe Atkins study. We think it's too soon to say how many people have it and who they are, because even the Zoe app only looked at people who had had a test. And we know that for some people, they couldn't get a PCR, a swab test. And we also know that the antibodies, some people don't have an antibody, strong antibody response. And then there was a study out from Imperial the day before yesterday that said antibodies drop off quite quickly. There's also the issue that if you are relying on people coming forward through apps, you're not really getting the whole population. And, you know, we're slightly worried about the people who are not logging onto an app. What do we know about their condition? What we would say is when we published our report, we embedded a survey in it. And in the first week, we had 4,000 responses. And we had a very significant number of women. And there's a number of people saying this now from different organisations and hospitals in England. This is conundrum, because obviously we know the deaths are more prevalent in men, but it does seem that women are more likely to experience long COVID. We also know that children have long COVID. So whilst children have a very low risk of dying, again, we don't know the numbers because nobody's systematically counting it at the moment. But there does seem to be a problem around children as well. So I was talking to a group of people with NHS England just today, and one of the things that we're all starting to think is that the risk factors for long COVID are different from the risk factors for being very ill and dying of COVID.
And given that antibodies disappear quite quickly, could long COVID be an underlying condition that would make people more vulnerable to COVID-19 itself?
I don't know. I mean, one of the things that we wanted to do with our report is shine a light on the fact that there are people who are experiencing these problems sort of 8-9 months after an initial infection. And what we need to do is take them seriously and do more research. Initially, we need to just map how many people have got it, and we need to map the pattern of their symptoms so we can see if there are subdivisions of long COVID, and we need to do some more biomedical research into what's actually causing it.
One of the things that seems to be common, and again I've read a few statements of people who've had long COVID, but one of the concerns that keeps coming up about people who've had long COVID is their relations with their employers and their work colleagues, because of the difficulty of nailing down what exactly is wrong with them. And as we've already mentioned, some or many of these people may not have had an original laboratory test. Employers may not believe that this is a real thing, but it is.
It's definitely a real thing. We don't understand about it. So in the UK, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, NICE, is actually starting to put together a case definition. And we've given evidence to them, and they are minded to say that it should be based on a clinical history with no need for any laboratory tests. But I think that will be very helpful for us in the UK. But we need to do work with employers, because the other thing is we know there are a lot of people who are now in their 8th month or 9th month of suffering for this, which means that they are at the end of their sick pay. And they're financially unable to pay their mortgage and meet their financial requirements. We also know from a number of different studies that there are a significant number of healthcare professionals who have long COVID, And so there's, you know, a real issue about how they are managed and making sure that when they are ready to return to work, they can do that in a staggered way rather than just go straight back into the thick of it, particularly as we're now seeing surges of acute infections again.
So finally then, COVID-19, the measures that are being rolled out to cope with that in terms of public awareness and social distancing and restrictions, etc., that's a public health concern that's very much in the public eye. But long term, what kind of a public health challenge does long COVID present?
Again, it's unknown. We don't know when people will recover from this. So there are people who have problems for sort of 6 weeks, and we think there's probably a distinction between those people and people who are now in month eight. The people who are in month eight, we don't at the moment know how long they're going to be unwell, and I think certainly that's something the public should be aware of, and certainly people who don't perceive themselves to be at high risk of dying of COVID really need to be thinking about, well, is there a risk of other consequences of not controlling the virus?
Thanks very much, Dr. Maxwell. We really appreciate your time.
Okay.
Now, as I said, with such little movement in Ireland's status, we're going to look instead at a country that has experienced a rapid rise in cases and hospitalisations, so much so that one doctor said he feared his area was going to be the new Lombardy, with medics being forced to make difficult choices about who to save and who not to save. The country is Belgium. The region in question is French-speaking Wallonia. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, travelled to the city of Liège there during the week to see the situation on the ground. So, Tony, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Colm, thanks. You know, staring into the abyss of another Belgian lockdown, which feels fairly imminent. It hasn't been confirmed yet, but the government is going to make an announcement tomorrow, being Friday, on what is widely expected to be a French-style lockdown, so everything shuts except schools, and the public and private sector keep working as much as they can, but the social life that we didn't really have fully anyway is going to be completely shut down, and there will be other restrictions on movement and exercise and so on. So that's what we're looking at here. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers in Belgium are just so terrible that there are not too many people complaining about it.
Well, give us an idea of that, because, I mean, you're in good company. Obviously, you've been looking at France and Germany during the week, but for the purposes of this conversation, let's concentrate on Belgium, where you are, because things are bad. We're talking somewhere in the region of anywhere between 650, 900, 1,000 cases in Ireland over the recent week or so. What are the figures like in Belgium, and how are the hospitals coping?
Yeah, I suppose the standout figure for me is 1,400 per 100,000 of population are positive, and that's comparing to about 300 for Ireland. So it's basically over four times worse than Ireland. Over the past week, we've had, you know, perhaps as many as 10,000 cases. I can just go into my Belgian coronavirus app and it gives me a quick snapshot. So yeah, 14,000 daily infections between the 19th and 25th of October. So that was up 40%. 469 daily hospitalizations, that was up 85%, and 69 deaths a day. So that's over 100% increase on the previous week.
And what's gone wrong, Tony? Because it has never really been good in Belgium as far as their coronavirus cases. Why has it been so bad, and why is it getting worse?
Yeah, well, I spoke to the chief virologist at the Belgian Institute for Health on Tuesday, and he was quite frank. He just said, look, we don't know. We don't fully understand why Belgium is once again at the top of the charts for infections and deaths. But then you get a run through of the factors that could be salient. So a relatively densely populated country, a very large expat community. You have, it's a crossroads geographically of Europe. And so at the end of the summer, you had everyone coming back from holidays because, let's face it, July and August, it felt like things were pretty much getting back to normal. Belgium started its relaxing its restrictions on the 4th of May. So you can guess that by the time summer came around, you know, people were in the mind frame of we're back to normal and let's go and enjoy ourselves. From Belgium, it's easy to drive to a lot of countries and have a holiday that people felt they deserved. So they all came back in September. Then schools reopened and there was a noticeable increase in the first couple of weeks in September. That was down to people coming back from holidays, several hundred thousand. When you add in all of the expats who come back to the European Union and NATO and some of the other multilateral organisations.
Right, quite a few big university towns as well in Belgium.
Yeah. Well, the university seems to have been a catalyst in really pushing the numbers up. The epicentre of that phenomenon was Liège, which is, you know, it's a very old historic town. As you head over towards Germany, it's in the Francophone Wallonia part of the country, famous for its opera. It has a lot of associations with World War One. A lot of people, Irish people, would know it quite well. It's a kind of a agglomeration of a lot of towns that have blended into each other, and it has 40,000 students. And what happened was they all came back kind of en masse to university and higher education. And I suppose in the froth of coming back to university, there was a lot of socializing. And the virus spread very quickly among that cohort. And typically in Belgium, students stay in an apartment in the city that they're studying Monday to Friday, and they go home at weekends. So these people were then bringing the virus home to their families. And you had this ripple effect right through the wider suburbs and urban area of Liège, and suddenly the hospitals there couldn't cope.
Now, you went down there on Tuesday. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we went down on Tuesday. We spoke to a guy from intensive care who was basically giving us the figures. I think there were 46 in intensive care at that point, but they were anticipating that going up to about 80, which would be the absolute maximum capacity of intensive care.
And this is in Liège alone. In Ireland,
Liège,
we
yeah.
have 46 so, in intensive care for the entire country, but these are just the figures for one city.
That was one hospital. I mean, there are three hospitals in Liège, and this was the Clinique Montlegia, which was a brand new hospital which just opened its doors in March. So it's very well equipped, but already they were facing real problems, mostly in staffing levels, because quite a few of the ICU staff came down with COVID themselves. And they were so short-staffed that they said to people, we don't care if you have it, as long as you're asymptomatic or only have mild symptoms, you still need to come in and help out.
So infected people are just being asked, infected hospital staff, because their specialism is needed, are being asked to just don a hazmat suit and keep working in the ICU unit.
Yeah. I mean, this was how bad it was. And I mean, there's been a general debate across Belgium about people being drafted into hospital settings from who are not medically trained, but who might somehow be able to help out or to free up people higher up the hierarchy who might have some medical expertise to bring to bear. They're now today announcing a mobilisation of patients who are non-COVID, getting them out of hospitals in acute areas and putting them into hospitals elsewhere. So these are patients who are maybe moved, you know, 100 kilometres away from where they live, being moved into nursing homes, all the time trying to free up more space for intensive care centres and operations. It is, you know, a really acute situation here at the moment.
And as he looked ahead, the intensive care specialist you were talking to, Dr. Laurent Jadot in Liège, what was he saying? What are their fears? Because Lombardy has been cited as to the situation hospitals would be facing with people looking down the barrel of very drastic triage decisions. Is that the kind of thing that you were hearing when you were filming in the hospital in Liège?
Yeah, I mean, two things which stood out there. One was this idea of bringing staff back in who were infected by the virus. And then this life or death decision that he was going to have to make. Now, he said perhaps 2 weeks, that was what they were projecting, where they would be in that triage situation, you know, coming to work one day and being told you have to separate those who might have a chance and those who are just not going to make it, those who are too old or where the level of infection is just too high. And he said, like, you know, I'm not trained for that kind of decision. That's not my job. My job is to save people. But that's what he was afraid of. You know, if you get into this level of pushing the limit on ICU beds up to 80, you're not going to have the ratio of one nurse per three patients. He said, then you're going to get into a five and six patients to one nurse, and then they can't give the care that they need. And that's another reason why people might die where they shouldn't be dying.
And in all of that, Tony, when you were in the hospital and conducting these interviews, what was your sense of the morale? What was the morale of that specialist? Was it rock bottom? Was it fatalistic?
It's funny, you go into a hospital and the atmosphere, it's not like ER, you know, there isn't sort of carnage, but everything is happening out of sight, you know, and we wouldn't be allowed near the intensive care unit itself. He just seemed tired and worried and just concerned for his colleagues and concerned for his patients and just wondering how they were going to manage. And ultimately he said, you know, they should have locked down sooner.
Do we know why they didn't?
Well, Belgium is a, you know, again, if you want to get into the facts as to why Belgium has apparently done so badly, you know, on the one hand, it has a first-class health system. Taxes are high in Belgium, and a lot of the tax spend goes into healthcare. But you have this very complex layering of public administration between regional and federal governments and local governments, and you even have parliaments based on the language. You have a Francophone parliament, you have a Flemish parliament, you have a German-speaking parliament, and you've got this highly ornate administrative network which kind of works well if there's no government at the federal level, which is something that Belgium has become accustomed to in recent years. But when it comes to making decisions that can be carried out by the public across the board, it's kind of harder. So there has been a lot more discretion at local level to have local lockdowns. I think in late August, early September, there was a local lockdown in Antwerp because a lot of people were socializing there and you suddenly had a sudden spike in infections. But another reason is that because the country is split between the Flemish-speaking north and the French-speaking south, both of those components tend to look to what's happening in either the Netherlands to the north or France to the south. And you get this kind of hedging effect where the regional governments, you know, hesitate before making decisions to see how similar decisions happen either in France or in the Netherlands, because, of course, there is an awful lot of movement back and forth. So you can understand perhaps why that hedging effect is there. But again, people will say, look, it's densely populated. It's a crossroads. We have a lot of traffic coming in and out. And that's really why the rates are so high.
Finally then, Tony, the summit, that's the informal summit that's taking place this evening virtually, with people not coming through that crossroads that you've just mentioned, the leaders of the countries of the European Union. What's expected in the form of white smoke out of that? Will there be any resolutions, or is this very much an exchange of views between leaders with no concrete proposals to emerge?
I think it's more of an exchange of views and, you know, trying to provide high-level political focus to the situation. I think Europe in general is terrified of a repeat of what happened in the spring. And you'll recall, I'm sure we talked about it a few times, the real difficulty for the European Union to show a united front, to get to grips with the shortage in medical supplies, in PPE, and then this terrible situation where Italy was crying out for help and Germany wasn't sending surplus medical equipment or taking Italian patients into their own hospitals, and Italy had to go to the European Commission to trigger a solidarity clause, and eventually Germany, you know, did respond, and the EU kind of got its act together then. And I think they're very worried about a repeat of that. Especially the second time round, it would be even worse because they've had the experience of the spring and they've had the summer to prepare for a second wave. And if they fall down for a second time, the morale would be pretty serious. But what they're looking at tonight, being Thursday night, is trying to coordinate how vaccines are developed and are distributed. And the European Commission has issued figures that they're not going to have enough vaccines for every single citizen in the European Union, which is 450 million people. That'll only be there by 2022. So they're going to have to prioritize different groups who need it more than others. And so what they're trying to do is to define a common criterion for which groups should get it first. And then there's the whole, you know, free movement of people. How do you make sure that the European economy doesn't grind to a halt? Making sure goods, again, can cross borders. Making sure that critical care can be shared where it's needed. And again, Germany has been taking in quite a few people from the Netherlands, and we're expecting them to take in people from Belgium as well. They also want to coordinate contact tracing apps. At the moment, 19 countries have developed these contact tracing apps. Only three, Ireland, Italy and Germany, have apps which interact with each other, and they want to roll that out across the EU. So again, this will be high-level political direction from leaders to say, look, just get this done. How can we do this? How can we make sure these apps are interoperable? How can we make sure that quarantine measures kind of are the same, so that people know where they stand when it comes to travelling, that they know where they can go, where they can't go, and so on. And another issue as well is trying to ramp up antigen tests. These are not the nasal swab, but blood tests where you can detect antibodies in the blood. And again, that's, you know, the turnaround rate there is much quicker, and that's seen as a better way of detecting clusters and to try and beat those clusters much more quickly, and to prevent the further escalation of the contagion.
All right. Well, look, thanks very much for that, Tony. We will be, if I get this published after midnight, I'll be saying we'll be talking later today. But seeing as we are talking still on Thursday night, and I am an optimist, we'll talk Brexit tomorrow on RTE's other podcast from the Foreign Desk, Brexit Republic.
Yeah, lots to talk about there.
Yeah, we won't get into it now. Chat later. All the best.
Okay.
Cheers,
thanks,
Tony.
Take
good luck.
Care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Now, that optimism of an early finish to the edit was misplaced. So happily, that means for you, listener, that I can bring you some of the conclusions of that summit in Brussels. €220 million has been set aside to transfer COVID-19 patients from hard-hit member states to their neighbouring countries with spare hospital capacity, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said earlier. She also wanted greater information exchange, because the good use of the money requires good information exchange. And that's a quote. Leaders also, they were urged not to close borders to each other, that the open borders were vital for the functioning of the European economy and therefore to combat the coronavirus. And the informal video conference hosted by the European Council President Charles Michel is supposed to become a semi-regular forum for EU leaders to coordinate their responses over the coming months. Obviously, because EU summits, face-to-face summits, that is, have been scaled back or postponed amongst fears that the coronavirus would spread further. And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter @colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.